The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, it's going to be a bit of a dark and grim subject matter, I'm afraid. We're going to take a look at the grooming gangs. And I thought, well, who do I know about that? Roger Meir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on. So you've made a bit of a name for yourself as a campaigner, primarily on this issue of what's been happening to the white working class and the grooming gang victims. So I've got to start with this. You know, you're a Muslim lad of Bangladeshi origins. Why does the plight of the white working class and the children bother you when, I suppose we come back to this point, it clearly doesn't bother the Labour Party, who are supposed to be the representatives of the white working class?
It's a fair question. Where do I start? I am a trained anti-racist. And what is taking place here is textbook racism. So if I believe in anti-racist work, and I spent 20 years advocating anti-racist strategies, built strengthening communities, then surely I have a responsibility to look at this as a clear example of racism. These are racially motivated crimes. And I had to speak out, first and foremost. Secondly, the children. I spent 20 years safeguarding children. And I have a career for at least that amount of time as well in protecting communities from extremism. I helped shape a lot of the government's thinking on how to fight against Al-Qaeda, essentially. So I look at this and all of those issues overlap. But in the end, this is my home. These are my communities. These children could have been my children. And no one was helping them. No one was speaking out on behalf of them. And those who were didn't have the skill set to navigate the traps that were set for them by the establishment, which then made it easy for people to be demonized. Yeah. And I can play that game for a whole host of reasons. And you know, one, I'm obviously brown-faced Muslim, like you said, but that's not stopped these idiots from calling me far-right and racist. We now all know, don't we, Dan? What does that term even mean?
Yes, yeah. we're all far right now.
Yeah. So, yes. So you know, you can
does it at least give you a bit of cover? Because I mean, there have been people who have spoken out about this sort of stuff, and they tend to get shut down by the state.
It makes it worse for me because the flip side is I have got to navigate the communities where I come from, mm-hmm. and being demonized as far right and racist.
Northern town.
It's a northern town, northern working class town, a small Bangladeshi community. My mother died nearly 18 months ago now. And towards the back end of her life, she was struggling with all of this, what was going on, because she's got a network of friends, extended family, who wanted to know why her son was wanting to help white people.
Mm.
And the pressures that came with that. And, why can't he stay quiet? It's got nothing to do with us. It's not our kids it's happening to.
Yeah, well, that is something that concerns me. The So two things on this. I mean, first, Carl always makes the point that I think for most of us, if we rang up 12 friends and said, look, I've got this, you know, young girl tied up upstairs. Do you want to come around and help rape her? I don't know how many people there are that would actually have 12 friends who would respond to that.
Well, I'd respond to that. I'd come and smack.
I think if I rang 12 of my friends, you know, within the first phone call, they would have reported me to the police.
Yes.
But for some reason, in the Muslim community, it seems like they can just ring up 12 of their friends, and not only do they not get reported, but they all sort of go along with it. So it feels like the Muslim community has failed the test of friendship. And as you've just talked about, there is that sort of omerta of silence that's sort of in there as well. And, you know, you can understand why people immediately sort of leap to, well, deportations are the only thing that are gonna solve this. I mean, what's your thoughts on this? Why is this community so comfortable with these crimes?
It's a question. One, I agree they are. I think that's the first thing we've got to... start with, I agree they are. And I think they are comfortable with these crimes because these crimes have been going on for such a long time in plain sight without any repercussions. So to answer your question as to why they're comfortable because those who are responsible can get away with it. The second reason why they're comfortable is because those who are involved in trying to safeguard them or attempting to safeguard them are also comfortable with these children being used the way they are. And it's only until very recently that we agree that it was always absurd to say that it was a lifestyle choice of an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old to be gang-raped.
In some cases, even younger than that.
So it was normalised as though acceptable, just one of those things that go on in society. And after all, these are girls that were damaged, and I'm not of that opinion. I'm sharing the perception. These are damaged children who brought it on themselves. They're in care homes, or the parents don't look after them. So if no one's caring for them, who cares?
Well, that was certainly the view of the police.
Yes, that was the view of the police. Yes. So you've got the view of the community, you've got the view of those who are meant to safeguard them, and you've got the view of those who are meant to protect them in terms of the police. And then you have the view of the politicians in the wider context who are meant to, you know, speak out on behalf and address some of these issues, and they looked at the situation and they thought they can benefit from it. So that's why it was normalized. There was not just one failing in one community. There was at least four different areas where those failings took place, and all are responsible and all are complicit.
So we must drill down into each of those, but before we get into that, let's talk briefly about the actual scale of the problem. How big actually is this problem?
When I was first told about this, probably at the time of the Rochdale grooming gang, I'd just done a piece of work in Manchester and Rochdale around some of the counter-terrorism strategy, and the EDL were coming up to protest in Rochdale. So around 2012, I reckon it was 2011, 2012. I'll be honest with you, Dan, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe that in 21st century in United Kingdom, children were being groomed, gang raped, and trafficked across the country in the way that was being presented as what had taken place. And I've gone away and looked at it. I've looked at the evidence. Is it Kemi Badenoch stood up in Parliament, and I'll paraphrase her, but she talked about the systemic grooming and gang rape of children across the nation. And she addressed Keir Starmer in the lead up to the vote, what they rejected, which is a vote for a national inquiry into what had taken place. So I would say to you, this is systemic across the entire country. This is systemic, particularly in communities where there is a significant Pakistani, Bangladeshi Muslim community living, you know, close with white working class communities. And I'd say in every one of those towns and cities, you will find this problem. These networks of men that I've then gone and looked at didn't operate in silos, in council areas, They ran cross-county trafficking of children in a similar way to how heroin is transported. And in many instances, many of these men involved are also the exact men who are involved in the heroin trade.
Right.
You know, yes, and children are
exclusive. So why not overlap?
Yeah, and children, yeah. You can sell heroin once, Dan. You can, as we found out from the harrowing cases, you can sell children 40, 50 times a night and sometimes to four or five men at once.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the EDL. I seem to remember that the BNP were the other ones
that spoke about this.
And I believe, what's his name, Nick Griffin
actually. Nick Griffin even spoke about this.
Well, I understand he actually went to jail for things that we now know to be true.
Nick Griffin?
Yeah.
I look at this and I've been on my own journey with this as well. And I say, okay, there's framing the, does it really exist? Which is one, the reasons why and the solutions. So I look at this and also who's responsible. And how I've been trying to navigate this is try and make sure that we accept that there are failings within the communities where I come from. But the communities where I come from, there are also people like me who want this dealt with. And we have been ostracized and sidelined by the very authorities that are involved in having failed these children and look the other way. This isn't just a, you can look at it in the lens of a racial lens or a religious lens. Fine, I accept there's arguments for that. I take it further. I say there's also very serious failings in our institutions who are meant to protect these children.
Oh, certainly.
And also, in our political class, what took place is that they benefited from the arrangement. I take it to a darker place where I say, and it's based on my experiences and my interactions and my understanding of this issue. I've given the last 6 years of my life to fighting for this. And before that, I've got 20 years of working at a senior enough level to understand how all of this plays out. And I'm very clear on this. Children, white working class children, were exchanged for votes.
Yes. Yes, I think that is exactly what happened. And you made a number of points that I want to circle back on, but essentially you're saying that the problem is so large we don't know how large it is.
If you were to ask me, yes. I would bet my last penny that we are talking at least 100,000 children.
100,000 children?
At least.
Minimum?
At least.
Okay. One of the other things you mentioned there was... And I do definitely want to build up to the failings of the police and local authorities and Labour Party and so on. But one of the things you mentioned there was ostracism within the community. So, I mean, what's it like coming from this community and speaking out about it? I mean, is it accepted that that something has to be done, or do you get shut up, don't talk about it, all that kind of stuff?
There was a police officer at my house yesterday, and that police officer had come round because I had been repeatedly reporting clear crimes by a network of Islamists who have been inciting my murder for the last 4 years at least. The right. Police have refused to arrest a single one of these because of their political correctness connections. But as recently as yesterday, there was a police officer in my house, and what these guys have been doing nonstop is they use their interpretations of Quranic scripture, their viewpoints and Sharia law to try and essentially put a fatwa on me, a religious doctrine to take me out. And what they're arguing around, or what the case they're presenting, is that I am a gay Christian convert. So for them, being gay from my background means you can yes. kill him. And being a Christian convert means you can not just kill him, but burn him.
He's pretty high up there on the get-you-killed list.
And, this stuff is regularly published and shared online with my photograph, my home address, everything. And these men are protected. The most recent case was shared on a WhatsApp group that they have, these men have, and translated, the word is bisar in it. Now, bisar translated is community judgment according to Sharia law. And that's what the word means. Right. And they'd generated an AI video of me involved in some homosexual act and happily distributed to thousands.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah. Right. With a view of trying to incite my murder.
Yes.
There's no ambiguity. So when you ask me, if That is what I'm dealing with.
I mean, you say their interpretations, but I mean, have they not got a point? Because a lot of people say, well, you know, the Prophet Muhammad took a 9-year-old bride, and you know,
yeah,
therefore, you could say that, you know, maybe they're not completely out of line on this stuff. And to be fair, that he did also take a dim view of people who committed apostasy and all that sort of thing. So I mean, it's a fairly lively career that the chap had.
And I look at that, and I'm not a religious expert at all. All I can share with you is that the Islam I was raised in, the mosque that I went to, and a generation of people like me, from, you know, I think Islam and the way in which Islam is experienced in the United Kingdom now is very different to how it was 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
Yes.
No. Even
Islam in Egypt in the 1950s is very, very different. Well, Iran, all of them.
Yeah.
Islam appears to have been moving significantly more radical over the course of the latter half of the last century.
Agreed. And I struggle with that. I struggle with it. And I always saw it as a spiritual thing. The people I went to the mosque with in the main were nice people who did nice things in the community, and it was a spiritual thing. It was no different than friends of mine going to church on a Sunday. Mm. Now, that's the Islam I grew up with. Mm. It wasn't this political experience that it is now. It wasn't this angry phenomenon that it is now. And it definitely wasn't one where practicing it puts you at odds with the nation that should be your home, which I think is
feel like we're there. It does feel like Islam is incompatible with this country.
And when I came down and I wanted to speak with you, and I watch your stuff, and not just you, and I see that, and I see why people think that. And even more so, I think, is that means I have a responsibility, and people like me from the communities I come from have a responsibility to fight within my own community, and also present to people outside that all of us are not like that. Yes. And we want, you know, we've got to find a way of living together. Because as a brown-faced Muslim man, I look at it this way, Dan. If we don't find a way of living together, then what happens next?
Mm. Well, presumably, the same thing happens as has happened in every other country where this has happened.
And I don't want that.
Quite nasty.
I don't want that.
Yes.
I've got a daughter. I want her to grow up in a nation that she's valued.
Mm.
And she values.
Because, I mean, one of the increasing talking points is about deportations, for example, and you know that sounds fine in principle, but you then have to start thinking, well, how am I going to do that if we are going to do it? Now, I think you probably wouldn't get an awful lot of pushback if it was okay, all the dual nationals or foreign nationals who committed crime, you know, especially the grooming gang crimes, if they all get deported. But then when you start hearing, okay, the community, you know, covers up for these men and accepts it, you then start to think, well, hang on a minute, maybe it needs to go a bit further than that. So I mean, how do you, if we are going to have some sort of recompense on any of this, short of deporting everybody who hasn't got native born British grandparents, how do you sort the wheat from the chaff? How do you delineate between those who are either complicit or culturally accepting of it, neither of which is acceptable, from those who are not like that?
It's a fair point. First of all, we agree. I think I think you're of that opinion. I agree that dual nationals who commit any crime that are of a certain tier,
yes,
should be, you know, what are they doing here? Or foreign nationals, what are they doing here?
Hmm.
Why waste our time with them? I mean, it's not an extreme viewpoint. Once it was considered an extreme viewpoint, but increasingly now I don't think that's an extreme viewpoint.
Yes.
If you're a foreign national or a dual national and you commit a crime, you know, of a sufficiency of perhaps where you get, you know, put in prison or whatever, then you should be automatically deported. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is any more an extreme viewpoint. What you've got to then understand, and it's the conversation I have with people, and I look at the likes of the Reform MP, Rupert Lowe, yeah. And he focuses in on this, yeah?
Yes.
And then I look on the community where I come from and the significant amount of people who have attitudes that facilitate the environment where those crimes take place.
Yes, that's the bit that I'm worried about.
The UK born. The parents are UK-born. The grandparents are UK-born. And the pattern I've seen that worries me, Dan, is that the more longer they've spent here, in terms of the family lineage, the children and the grandchildren are actually more at odds with the, you know, and unwilling to embrace than the grandparents were. Does that make the less integrated?
And where is that coming from?
It's political Islam. I look at it.
Is that coming from the mosques?
No, it's not. It's not even from the mosques. This has moved on from the mosques.
Right.
This is now a global news channel of how they perceive their identity. They'll turn on the internet. They'll turn on the phone. They'll see someone in Gaza. They'll see someone, you know, some radical cleric in Egypt, and that's where it's coming from. And we're not able to counter it here. The mosques I go to will fight tooth and nail to say you are here, you abide by the rules, you abide by the laws, and you do the best you can. This isn't coming from the mosque in the United Kingdom. This is coming from this global ummah that these guys have bought into, and girls, and they hate me for it. They hate me for speaking out against it. I'm like, okay, so if you went to Saudi Arabia, how would you be treated? If you went to Afghanistan, how would you be treated? You're turning your back on the very country that's given you a home, and you're developing a mindset where the place you live is your enemy.
Yes. Well, of course, there are no churches in Saudi Arabia. I wonder about this because, I mean, should there be mosques in the United Kingdom? Because clearly there are some very bad ones. You know, or it's either that or they have extreme bad accident to keep churning out extremists. So you tell me there are some that are pushing back against it. I've never been to one, so...
I've never been to one. I mean, and I'm not the best Muslim. Let's be clear. You know, I try my best, but I'm not the best Muslim. And there are people in my own community who would argue that I'm not a Muslim. So let's get that out there first for those who watch this. But my experience of the mosques is that none of the mosques I've ever been to encourage any of this that we oppose. Increasingly, I have seen, I've witnessed firsthand, you know, in terms of the videos and stuff that are sent to me, some Islamic scholars who give sermons that I find uncomfortable. Now, a few years ago, I remember the government's prevent strategy that's just been ripped apart, I think, recently. With events in Southport, and I remember being sat in meetings helping design that strategy. We recognised and accepted that there was a doctrine coming up, an Islamic strand coming into the United Kingdom, actually from Saudi Arabia, but no one was willing to really challenge it because of our links with the Saudis, and I've heard links with the Saudis.
So Wahhabism.
The Wahhabis, yeah.
Right.
And it kind of superimposed and went over the softer sort of cultural Islam, you know, that many of us had experienced before, and it was a more fundamental strand. Now, I haven't got the answers for that. Now, if you get to a point where we say, okay, every mosque should be shut down, surely I and all those like me have a responsibility to make sure that we do whatever is necessary before that becomes...
Yes.
What is that?
Yes.
And I haven't got the answers for you. What I do know is what we're doing isn't working.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that what you're doing is very important. And clearly there must be more of that sort of thing. I'd like to see sort of more from your community sort of come forward.
I agree.
And do this.
I agree.
Because all the time that isn't the case. I mean, my mind doesn't automatically go to mass deportations, you know, widespread and complete. But if there is no other solution to protect children, well, I'll protect the children.
I'm with you. I'm with you. And I look at the protecting of the children. And if we can't agree on that, something as fundamental as that, we're not going to agree on anything, are we?
So let me just dive into this, because this is interesting. The point about, and certainly Wahhabism is very extreme, emerging from Saudi Arabia. I have seen comments from the Saudi government that basically says to the UK government, you need to deal with these people with an iron fist. That's what we do. And they don't mess around with their internment centres.
Yeah.
And so they've been telling our government, you need to come down on these people brutally. And of course, our government doesn't do anything of the sort. But how does it practically, if you're a 17-year-old Bangladeshi lad, are you going to be watching? Because and I get with the social media today, it tends to be the most strident voices that get a disproportionate amount of attention. So are you, are 17-year-old Bangladeshi lads or whatever, or Pakistanis, are they watching videos coming out of Saudi Arabia? I mean, do they speak Arabic for a start?
No, a lot of these are English, aren't they? A lot of these are English. Of these are English speaking.
But they're watching clerics from Saudi Arabia do
or the interpretation of people of the clerics from Saudi Arabia or from Afghanistan or, you know.
Well, they share it and they watch this.
And it's increasingly become one where I look at this from a, you know, someone who's two generations away, perhaps, but still live in that community, where the culture of the homeland here, the culture, is increasingly held in contempt and looked down on as inferior. It's classic racism.
Hmm.
Now, they frame it through religion, but it's still the same. It's classic racism. You are less than. You know, your culture is less than. Your girls are promiscuous, the this, the that, the trash.
Well, that came out very strongly in the court transcripts.
Yeah, yeah. And then what happens to them? They deserve it.
Yes.
And how do we stop that? First, we've got to accept there were racially motivated crimes. For the last 6 years, I've been shouting and screaming about this, and we've got nowhere with it yet because the government doesn't even accept these are racially motivated crimes.
So on that narrow point, there was no institutional acceptance whatsoever of it, that it was group-based and it was racist.
What? They're struggling with it. Right. They won't even... Last week, in my own council chamber, and I went to the meeting, an elderly Conservative councillor, Pam Byrne, stood up. And remember, Oldham had wrote to Jess Phillips, and Jess Phillips wrote back saying, no, you can't have a public inquiry, but you can have a local one.
Yes.
And the local one means you can mark your own homework,
like
you did last
time.
Yeah. And she stood up and she said, well, we should go back to the government. She's probably in her 80s, mate. Yeah. Mm. She stood up, bravely stood up and read a piece of paper that she'd prepared. And she used the term Pakistani heritage rape gangs. The Pakistani leader of the council stood up, outraged. The white deputy mayor told her to take those words back straight away. And she said, which words? In other words, he wanted to take him back? Pakistani. We can't even speak about it.
Hmm.
That's in a council chamber last week in a town that's at the epicentre of the grooming gangs.
What? Why? Well, actually, before we go on to Labour...
There's a liberal, you know, belief undercurrent. Yes. It's not a political undercurrent per se. Yes. There's a liberal, you know.
Because I mean, we come back more to Labour, but I understand for them, somebody like Jess Phillips, she's got a majority of less than 700 over essentially the Islamic candidate.
Yeah. The sectarian, he's an Islamist candidate. Let's be clear. They're Islamist candidates, yeah?
Yes.
There's five Islamist MPs in Parliament.
Yeah, there are, yes. Yes. Yes, so I kind of understand why Labour got themselves into a trap, and we do definitely want to come back to that. But bear in mind, we have had since, 14 years of Tory leadership. Why did you get no traction with the Tories? Because they are not politically beholden to Islam the way that the Labour Party is.
No, the constituencies aren't. And I look at it, and I look at it, and look at it. I saw the report that came out of the Home Office. Was it 100,000 of us had to sign a petition to force them to release this report? And even then, the report, they said no. And we went through, you know, a whole host of hurdles, and the report was a whitewash. I think it's very, very clear that the Conservatives were not, even though you said 14 years, and I agree with you, and I'm not a Conservative, I don't think they're in control of the civil service.
Right.
I think it's as simple as that. I think there was a war between the ministers and the senior civil servants.
Yes, and their departments. This is a point that Connor makes, that there is a... especially in the Home Office, a large cadre of basically Islamic staff.
Agreed.
Who are sort of blocking this stuff. So they've kind of got themselves in as a sort of fourth column.
Agreed.
Right.
Whoever mentioned that to you, I agree with him.
So, I mean, okay, maybe. So we could maybe excuse the... Well, not excuse, but we can condemn the Tories for being weak because they are weak on
Braverman should have done more.
Yeah.
Liz Truss now speaks out, but she spoke out very little at the time.
Yeah. Well, she wasn't there for very long. So yes.
No. I mean, even when she was, you know...
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes.
Not enough of them spoke out. And this is why I get angry at it, because you all got played. Because in the lead up to the elections and the leadership contest, they all talked about, well, I'm going to deal with grooming gangs. I'm going to deal with grooming gangs. You know, Sajid Javid said it. You know, they all spoke about it. So they all know it's an issue. Mm. You know, the not dealing with it isn't as a consequence of ignorance, is it, Dan? They knew. They knew it was an issue. Yes. They knew it was enough of an issue for them to make reference to it when they were trying to get themselves votes for whatever positions they were looking to secure. But as soon as they secured those positions, they were unable or unwilling or just found it too difficult. I don't know. You'll have to ask them why.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose possibly it could be that if you are going to talk about a problem, at some point you're going to have to talk about a solution, and they can't imagine one, or at least they're not. They can't imagine one which they're willing to actually sort of go ahead and do, because it comes back to my earlier point about, you know, sorting. Because unless you basically say, I'm going to deport everybody of a certain heritage, well, that would probably solve it. But that is so far beyond the imagination of the sort of liberal consensus that we operate in today. You're going to need some sort of delineation that comes in there, which is why I asked about that earlier.
And there are steps, yeah. And I would say, in terms of the first steps, we have to recognise that there is a racist problem in the Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Muslim, whatever term you want to identify that subsect of our society.
Yes.
There is a racist problem there who look upon the majority white community with contempt, clearly through the lens of racism, in classic racism as perhaps in the 50s or 40s, in the other way around, you know, how the in particular, you know, the stories of the African Caribbeans and how they are treated. And look how society has moved on now, where there would be very few people who would look upon the African Caribbean community, the traditional sort of Windrush community from Barbados, and hold them with contempt. They've integrated, they've overcome whatever adversities they've had, and we've come to live with each other. But we went on a journey with the host community to do that. Mm. Which government is willing, brave enough, to look in a camera and say there is a problem in our minority communities towards the way in which they look upon the wider white community? Mm. That problem is endemically racist, and we have a duty to put in place programs to address that racism.
Yes, I mean, two things. I mean, one, when you say minority communities, I mean, quite often they're the majority in a lot of the towns where this is a big problem. And secondly, on the contempt, I've got some sympathy for that line of thought, because people who won't defend themselves actually are contemptuous.
I campaigned and campaigned and campaigned for so long in my hometown on this issue, and to politically mobilize, because that's what we did with the white working class. We politically mobilized them to remove the white political leaders who'd betrayed them. It was hard work for 6 years.
But so many of them.
You know, and even then, we did it with a small number of, I reckon, about 200 people. We changed the entire landscape, political landscape of the town with 200 people, mainly elderly and white. The younger ones won't get involved.
Yes.
The middle-aged ones look around and think their jobs are at risk, if they say anything. And
so, how much of this is just fear? Because I mean,
it's not just fear. They've been disempowered. They're disillusioned.
Fear must be a factor, because you've already talked about how you've had death threats. Oh, absolutely. And all the rest of it. You know, Tobby Robinson is in and out of jail for doing things that are actually fairly innocuous that no one else would go to jail for.
They've been trying to put me in jail for 5 years, Dan.
Yeah,
5 years.
And just after the Southport massacre, you know, people who spoke out about it and actually said things that were, you know, perhaps not polished, but not
worth going to prison. Not worth going to prison. Come on.
Loads of them have gone to jail.
Well, they were made. It's political. It's political persecution. You're being made an example of, so the rest of the country looks at those people and thinks, "I better not say anything. I better not do anything in case that happens to me."
Yes,
that was on purpose. That was a political strategy.
Hmm.
What took place after Southport and the way in which the fast track persecutions took place?
So fear must have a lot to do with this, because you know, if you're working. And if you want to pay the mortgage, you can't speak out about this. Even if you're in the fortunate position where you can speak out about it, you have to be a bit careful, because one, you might get arrested by your own government, and two, you might get beaten up or murdered. So fear is it feels to me like that is a big factor, and that is a function of power.
Agreed.
If we had a government that was operating on a different software, you know, that top down aspect wouldn't exist.
Agreed. I'm not going to disagree with you on that, Fee. Absolutely.
Hmm.
And it's a strategy, and people are scared. They're scared to speak out, and they look towards their own immediate family unit and think, okay, as long as we're okay, then I won't say anything. Hmm. And I think that's 100% an issue. And then what we've also got is those who've managed to speak out, or the government has, you know, facilitated those space. They've been demonized as extremists. And then if you do speak out, well, actually, you're not just scared. You'll be branded as,
yes,
you know, you'll be branded.
So as well as people trying to kill you, and you mentioned they've tried to put you in jail.
Absolutely.
What's going on here?
The place where I come from, the leader of the council, is the current leader of the council, is a woman called Arood Shah. All of this is factual. There's nothing anyone will get into any trouble over. Arood Shah hangs off the arm of a man called Irish Emmy. Irish Emmy is the convicted heroin dealing getaway driver of the cop killer Dale Cregan.
So that name again, it sounds like
Dale
Irish...
Cregan. Dale Cregan?
No, the other.
Emmy. Irish Emmy is his name, is his nickname.
He's Irish Jimmy.
Emmy.
Oh.
Imtiaz. Irish Emmy. Right. And Muhammad Imran Ali is his real name.
Right, okay.
But he was the getaway driver,
yes,
of the cop killer Dale Cregan. Dale Cregan killed two police officers. One of them was from my town.
Yes.
The leader of the council hangs off his arm and he goes to council meetings with her. He campaigns for the Labour Party. So straight away...
I mean, that's a bad look.
And straight away, you've got organised crime and the politicians and that clear connection there. Despite that bad look, she is Andy Burnham, who's the Greater Manchester Mayor. She's his equalities lead. And also, she's the chair of the National Constitutional Committee of the Labour Party. So what I'm saying to you is these people are powerful.
Yes.
They're powerful, not just with their underworld links, but they're also powerful with the political power that they
So I'm
wield.
Hearing all of this for the first time. So another failing on the multitude of failings is, of course, the media. Who, I mean, in a normal functioning society, a connection like that would be a political death wish.
They're not interested. And if they are, they brush it, you know. And what took place with that is that I began to speak out against not just the grooming gangs, but in the way in which the postal vote was used. Postal vote harvesting, it's a real thing. Very easy now because of what Tony Blair did. Anyone can have a postal vote. Essentially what happens is in the community I come from, people get a postal vote. If you've not got a postal vote, someone will knock on your door and get you to fill in a form. So you do get a postal vote. You sign your postal vote. You sign your family's postal vote. You don't put the X anywhere and you hand over the envelopes.
Mm.
The fraud is as simple as that.
Yes.
Yeah. And these are gangsters clearly who organized that. I spoke out against it. I spoke out against the grooming gangs. These people are powerful enough that they instructed Greater Manchester Police to repeatedly arrest me on malicious fabricated.
So you've been arrested, what, put in the back of the police van?
Dawn raids on my house, Dan. Repeated dawn raids on my house. First time, 8 police officers dawn raided my house. I am a decorated individual. I don't have a criminal record.
Well, you got an MBE.
I have.
For Christ's
sakes. I have. Yeah.
Given to you by the Queen, no?
Given to by the Queen. They dawn raided my house, repeatedly dawn raided my house, dragged me into the police station. And the long and short of it was, they'd not even taken the statements from the likes of Arood Shah who'd complained against me. And I was told I'm politically campaigning, I'm saying things that shouldn't be said, and I'm going to be dealt with. Now, the issue we've got is I was not only charged, it took 6 months before they charged me. The one time they managed to charge me. And for that charging to have taken place, the CPS would have to have been involved. So the CPS, you know, we think of the police, the CPS, you know, we've got checks and balances, haven't we? Now, democracy, we've got checks and balances. There are no checks and balances here, Dan. The CPS were complicit in aiding fabrication of cases against me. The police arrested me at the instructions of politicians. In Greater Manchester, and this is what the government now want, they want to replicate this model across the country. They want more and more metro mayors. Metro mayors are also the police and crime commissioner. So politicians are in charge of the police. And then the police go and do what the politicians tell them to do.
Streamline the corruption.
Yeah.
Have you spoken to barristers about, bringing action for false arrests and all the rest of it?
All of that. I've spoken to them of all of that. But they drag it out, Dan. 3 years, my last, from being arrested to the court trial. And
the process is the punishment.
Yeah, the process. 3 years it took me. My mother died with me still on, awaiting trial. Of course, the trials, every time they came, collapsed because there was no evidence.
And what are the coppers like, the rank and file coppers like when they're dealing with you? And are they belligerent or are they embarrassed or what?
Oh, they're embarrassed. They're humiliated. I remember the first time a senior police officer is nodding at this young man, a young police officer, to put me in handcuffs. I'm in my underpants. Done. It's 6 in the morning. Yeah. And he refused. He refused to put me in handcuffs. I watched that exchange and I had more sympathy for what was going on, because it was clear that this was a politically motivated arrest and the police officers, the rank and file, were uncomfortable.
Extraordinary.
I've spoken with senior police officers and they are all very clear that as soon as the police and crime commissioners came along, as soon as the politicians came along to hold that position, particularly like in my town, Labour Party, it's a Labour Party mayor, Andy Burnham, he delegates the police and crime commissioner role to a woman called Kate Green, who was a former Labour Party MP. They all take care of each other. It creates an environment where that complicity of corruption is just easy.
So you think is at that highest, the corruption with the police is at the highest level? Because I've often thought that the way to deal with the police is just fire everybody above the rank of sergeant.
No, it's at the highest level.
And rebuild it.
At the highest level.
Okay. 100%. You think often the senior inspectors and chief constables, they're 100%. All right.
There is no way my arrest, in the way it took place, would have happened without sign off from the highest level.
Right.
No chance. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a nutcase. This is someone who just looks at it analytically, and there's no way. No way. And I've challenged Andy Burnham. I've challenged the Greater Manchester Mayor to launch an investigation into what's taken place. And he's just sidestepping the issue all the time.
So we've covered the community, the police, the Tories, who we agree are weak and pathetic, the media. What about the Labour Party?
The Labour Party benefit from this arrangement. They benefit from the arrangement where postal vote harvesting takes place. They are dependent on the Muslim bloc vote in something like 80 constituencies across the country.
I forget the precise number of votes, but there's 34 Labour seats where they're in a whisker of losing against the Islamic candidate.
81, the Muslim vote lot, and the Muslim vote lot came out of the Gaza thing, the sectarians, they can't stand me, which is fine. I don't want to live in a world that they control. They calculated 80, I think it was 80 or 81 constituencies as of now, and the number's growing because demographic changes, but 80 to 81 MPs they can directly impact upon. And what took place when the 30 or 40 that were within a whisker of losing, what took place was a Labour Party mobilised their Muslim element. Mm. So what's taking place in our communities, Dan, is that there's a cartel element which the Labour Party controls still. These are the drug dealers. Mm. These are the ones who the cozy arrangement currently is with. These are the ones who the grooming gang members and whatnot are. So Shabir Ahmed, the ringleader of the Rochdale grooming gang, came from my town. He was from Oldham, worked in the council for 18 years with access to children, and he was a senior member of the Labour Party in the town. All of that always overlaps. Consistently, where you see one, you'll see the other, and that pattern is always there. So what took place was when the general election was fought, there was two factions of Muslims' votes that they were going for. The Labour Party mobilised those, the traditional sort of cultural guys and those with the links to the organised crime who'd benefited from a whole host of arrangements, and the sectarians mobilised the Islamists.
So the Labour Party traditionally was thought of as an alliance between the working class and the metro lefty elite.
The Disburys and the Charltons, but where I come from.
Is there a third element, which is basically just political Islam? And I understand how the working class base and the London lefties, I understand how they've merged together and they can work comfortably together and they seem to get over the conflict quite well. But it sounds like you're describing the Islamic wing of this, the third leaf of the clover here, has also sort of seamlessly integrated into it as well.
Just in the lead up to the general election, Angela Rayner went to a Muslim house.
Ah, yes, I remember.
Yes. You'll have seen her dressed in a longer dress.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not the mini skirts.
No. She was dressed in a longer skirt, yeah?
Yes.
And she was in the living room of a kingpin in Tameside. And there was at least 20 or 30 men there, all Muslim men there. And she was advocating of how she is with them. Hmm. You've asked me a question. I've demonstrated to you what I think is the answer.
Yes. I mean, she's Minister for Safeguarding, but she appears to be safeguarding the rape gangs.
Oh, Jess Phillips.
Yes.
Yeah, Jess Phillips. Yeah, so Jess Phillips shouted down. She had an exchange at the count, didn't she? Remember, she had an exchange with the count with the Muslim men.
Yes, I remember.
But she wouldn't. She avoided making reference to the religious viewpoints or the cultural viewpoints. She wants to focus on them as men. I'm sorry. sorry. You or I wouldn't be ranting at her that way, would we? You know, they're doing what they're doing not because they're men, but because they have a specific viewpoint on the world.
Yes, quite.
Underpinned by either the cultural prejudices or the religious perspective.
So, I mean, let's play this forward, because obviously this is corrupt to the core. The media won't do anything. The police won't do anything.
Media are complicit. Where I come from, the media is very much, journalists are very much of the left.
Yes.
You know, they live in those sorts of, this is their ideology and they'll defend it to the hilt. And also they'll defend it to the hilt because they don't have to experience the lived reality of what the consequences of this not working is, because they live in those nicer areas where they can be far away from all of this stuff.
Because I'm inclined to believe that once you got to the point that we're at now, which is there are openly Islamic five, openly Islamic six, if you include...
Well, Liz Truss described them as Islamist MPs.
Yes, let's just call them Islamist MPs. So there are five or six Islamist MPs, openly Islamist MPs. At that point, it kind of makes me think, well, there is going to be an inevitable conclusion to this, which is that will grow. And basically, white people will look at that and say, I have to vote for a white identitarian. Even if your inclination is, oh, I want to weigh up tax policy A against tax policy B and social policy A versus social policy B. If there are Islamic candidates who are preaching my group over your group, well, I'm going to have to pick somebody who's a white identitarian. I have to. And then once you go down that route, you basically get, well, something that has happened many times in many countries before.
You've seen it.
Am I being overly pessimistic? Because no. I think that's going to happen.
I describe them as Islamist MPs. Hmm. You know, and let's be clear what Islamist means. You know, these are people who believe in a global caliphate.
Yes.
You know, fundamentally, that's what we're talking about here, Dan. Let's be very clear on what the desired outcome is of these people. And I will fight tooth and nail against that.
What would UK look like if it was even more Islamically dominated than it? Let's say this carries on creeping. And by 2050, Islam is a majority in this country. And they basically lock up political control. And there is token opposition, but it's effectively meaningless. What would an Islamic Britain look like?
I have spent a lot of time looking at this and working out, you know, worst case scenario, what does it look like? I think they is the term I use, I think they will carve out parts of the country that is semi-autonomous sort of rule.
Right.
You know, there are enclaves that will belong to them where they live by their rules.
Which would sort of necessitate basically evicting those who are not of the group. Because one of the things I hear about, one of the reasons I'm perhaps a little bit reticent on the mosques is the whole parking jihad thing that goes on. A new mosque will be put up in a sort of white working class area, and then the mosque attendees will park in front of the driveways around it, and it starts off as that, and then they say, okay, well, it's only while service is on, and then they start parking on their driveways, and then they just start parking, and it's basically a way to force people out of that area to make it so intolerable that they have to, and then they own a sort of area and they build an enclave. So it's going to kind of be that, it'll be like that, but on cities, but
with rules and laws. Yeah.
Yes. Well,
where else? Yes. You know, let's have an honest conversation. Where else will this go if this continues the way it does?
Well, the next step from that is if you clearly, and goes back to my point about I've got some sympathy for them having contempt for the white people of this country.
Well, I'm angry. Why on earth do you not get off your ass and vote? Why on earth do you not mobilise?
Well, okay, so one argument would be that people have been voting. And a colleague of mine on the Lotus Eaters went through basically every manifesto since the war. And basically, at every election, the party which was most anti-immigration won the election. So the British people probably think they have been doing something by at least curbing the flow coming in. But they've been consistently lied to.
And so once they get elected...
Yes,
they don't follow through on the pledges.
And going back, think about I've got some sympathy for the Islamists having contempt for the white population because they have allowed this to be done to themselves.
Well, if you don't respect yourself, who's going to respect you?
But ultimately, you can push people only so far. And at some point, it's difficult to see that there won't be widespread violence.
And history will teach us that, is exactly what happens.
Yes. I mean, we had a guest on the podcast not so long ago who... an older lady who in her youth as a teenager, she was in Delhi when one of these sporadic outbreaks of group warfare broke out. And, you know, she came back to her university wing or whatever, a dormitory, to find two dead Sikhs in her hallway. You know, this sort of stuff does sort of happen.
And what makes us think we're better than other parts of the world where this has happened? Because I don't think we are.
Yes.
I think it's, you know, I think unfortunately human nature is human nature. What's happened in Iran can happen here. What happened in India can happen here. Why not?
Mm. Do you see a solution that is not that?
Yes. That solution has got to be people from my communities have got to change and have got to be part of the solution and have got to step forward more. And those who say, oh, it's always on us, well, then tough. It is on you. Mm. It is on the minority community to adapt and integrate. But at the same time, the problem I've got, Dan, is that those in power facilitate the segregation, facilitate the separateness, and excuse the barbaric behaviour that no one should tolerate.
And
why? For short-term gain.
Yes.
Because it always goes back to politics. For me, it always goes back to power. What are the easy decisions those in positions of power can make to make sure that the block vote is secured in the way it always has been?
Well, and coming from your community, you can easily make the argument that that is in their self-interest, because otherwise we get to something much worse than violence. But that does require you to basically be a bit smarter than average and think about the future. You need to be, you know, living in the future. And
is that not the role of leaders, Dan?
Yes.
Is that, you know, I accept not everyone thinks that way. Not everyone looks at the world that way. But surely our leaders should look that way.
But and how do leaders pushing that message gain traction with the, as we talked about, the 17-year-old lad who is currently watching videos?
Give them a place to belong. Encourage them. Support them. Mm. I think it can be done. I've seen it done. It can be done. Look at some of the other communities we've got in this country. Are you going to tell me that the Indians aren't integrated? Or the Chinese, perhaps, or the African Caribbean, you know, in terms of the Windrush generation? Mm. Are any of them ever going to look at you and say that they're not British? Is anyone from this country going to identify cultural traits that they think are at complete odds with our way of life and living here?
Mm.
which is where we currently are having this conversation, aren't we?
Yes.
On Islam is incompatible with the West.
Yes.
Now, there's a set difference between Islam being incompatible with the West, and we can have that ideological conversation, and the reality of the lived experiences of the Muslims who are living here. They have a duty and a responsibility.
Why do we call it a Pakistani rape gang problem as opposed to a Muslim rape gang problem?
Because the large demographics of those we've come across are not just Pakistani, but they're from a specific area of Pakistan called Mirpur. So when you drill it down they're from a specific area of Pakistan called Mirpur.
I'm not familiar with that.
No. So Mirpur was one of the valleys in Pakistan that got flooded for some dam. And in the 50s and 60s, that tribal sort of clan community was displaced. The United Kingdom needed cheap labour, and there was that exchange. And that community is also where you'll find, I think it was recently made the news as well about the challenges of first cousin marriage.
Yes.
So all of that. Yeah.
Well, that's a further complication with my argument that you need to be a little bit smarter and see down the road. Yeah. If you've been marrying your own cousins for the last 20 generations.
What's going to happen? Yeah.
Yes.
And so why aren't we passing legislation?
So not to be racially insensitive or anything, but this area of Pakistan, is that like the rednecks?
Kenny Badenoch, you did a speech or she did an interview with GB News recently.
Yes.
And she described them as peasants.
Okay.
So that's what she meant. She didn't have the courage to link it specifically to that.
But they're the Pakistanis.
But the peasants that she makes reference to is that. Yes.
But they're the Pakistanis that other Pakistanis look down on.
They're the Pakistanis that other Pakistanis say, we're not like them.
Ah, I see. And those are the ones that we thought, yes, we have them en masse and we bring all of them in. Right, that was a possible error. Right, okay.
Do you see?
Yes, that's not helpful. So,
it's like the, and again, I'm not casting racial dispersion, but yes. The Roma community, they're not reflective of the Romans, Romanians, are they? You understand there's like a Roma community, there's like an underclass that's moved into this country, yeah?
Yes. Yes, quite. Okay. Yes, no.
I'm trying to give you a parallel lap.
Yes, because of course, when you're dealing with group levels, you just tend to see everybody the same. I mean, I get very embarrassed when I travel around the world and I see some guy with his shirt off and his beer belly making a noise about football and all the rest of it. And I just think, oh dear.
And being disrespectful to his environment. And that's not a reflection of you as an Englishman, is it?
No, certainly not, sir. No, absolutely. Okay. So one of the things that I had thought is that the reason why you were able to make traction with some of this stuff is because you are from that community and therefore that gave you a certain level of cover. But it sounds like you don't actually get treated much better than, Tommy Robinson or anyone else who speaks out on this.
No. They've tried to put me in prison several times.
Yes.
These gangsters have tried to have me killed. The politicians have called outright openly in Parliament, stood up and called me far right and racist.
Yes.
The newspapers have run stories on me, portraying me as a criminal. They're just... I just come at this from a different starting point. I spent 20 years working in this field, so I can navigate this in a different way. I think that's, if there's a difference, that's what I'd say.
And what would your message to the white community be then? Because, if you're going to get attacked for this, no matter who you are, you can't do that thing where you basically just have to wait for a brown person to speak out on your behalf, which is kind of what the Tories have done with appointing Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah.
They're so afraid of making right-wing arguments or anti-immigration arguments, but they thought, well, if we put Kemi Badenoch in, then she's allowed to, make those.
But she doesn't understand it well enough. You can see.
Yes.
Just because you're just because you're brown-faced or black-faced doesn't mean you necessarily see the world differently.
So any white people who are not speaking out are basically coping. They need to be much more strident as well.
And in the town we come from, we politically mobilised an entire town. They called it toxic politics. They tried to shut us down, but we have removed Labour from power. It took us 5 years, 6 years of campaigning, three leaders in a row, white working class communities. We've gone out, we've mobilised them, we've trained them, we've educated them, we've put up candidates from these communities. We've politically educated an entire town now. And the consequence of that is what forced that letter to Jess Phillips. There's no point going and protesting on the streets. I don't mean that disrespectfully. You can go and protest on the streets and have your day out if you think that'll work. I'm telling you now that won't work. The only way you can hurt these people, the only way you can fight back is through the ballot box, and that's by removing them from power and replacing them with your own.
Well, I mean, that was the original sort of conception of the EDL, wasn't it? It was white working class activism. But, I mean, that attracted the full ire of the state and was shut down very quickly. So how did this one not get shut down?
How did it? Because I navigated it. Because I have a skill set and I navigated it. And even though they tried to shut me down, even though they repeatedly arrested me, I have nowhere else to go, Dan. Fundamentally, these are my people. I might not look like you, but, you know, this is my home. And I know, looking ahead, what can happen. I've been in parts of the world where that has already happened.
Well, it's quite commonplace amongst the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I want nothing to do with it. And if I can fight for it, and so what if they put me in prison? So what if they antagonise me? My tactics aren't criminal. I understand democracy.
Yes.
And I understand the levers through which we achieve change.
And are you hopeful that this could be navigated through? I mean, we do seem to have some more powerful allies these days. I mean, Elon Musk has been rather helpful lately.
It's been brilliant. I mean, whatever anyone says, until he spoke out the way he did and used his power to just look at it and say, oh, what on earth is going on here with the gang rape of children? They'd managed it, hadn't they? The establishment here had contained it. The media had contained it. They'd left it in a space, oh, let's talk about the cultural dynamics of this at best. But no one ever went to the political space. And now the conversation has shifted to where it's now more and more people recognize this is about politics and power. These are informed decisions. The cover-up of the gang rape of our children and the exchange of our children for votes is a political decision made by people in power who benefit from that.
So are the Labour Party utterly screwed at this point? Because they, as we talked about, they need the Islamic vote, but they definitely need the white working class vote.
Well, and what they've done with the white working class vote historically is they've demonised and dispossessed them, and these people don't vote. They're disempowered, disengaged. And when they have voted, they voted for those sorts of parties that have never got in power. And then it's just not been organised. Now, the white working class in the town I come from is now an organised force. And we can take out politicians, and we have took out Labour Party politicians in Labour Party strongholds across the board.
So does that suggest a tie-up with Reform?
I've spoken with a couple of the MPs. I'm hopeful that they grow, because they're an early, you know, they're a young. I'm hopeful that they grow to become a genuine political party with some clear policies and engage with a working class community that is desperately looking for someone to represent them. I go into these places and it's clear to me Reform is the only show in town. People have invested in a belief that this is all that can save us.
Yes.
You know, the Tories don't understand it, or they tiptoe around it, like you've said. Labour have completely betrayed us.
I mean, Reform still do a bit of tiptoeing.
Of course. Yes. Well, I'm not a Reform supporter anymore than I'm a Conservative. You know,
I
speak and try and engage with as many people as possible because I want a public inquiry into the gang rape of children, and I think I need to engage with people from across all political viewpoints.
Do you think it can be done through civic institutions and all the rest of it? Or do you think that deportations are wrong? I mean, would you
I'm all for deportations.
Yes.
Let's be clear. I think there are specific, I think we've got to a place where, like Shabir Ahmed, and he, the ringleader of the Rochdale Grooming Gang, I think he's due out next year, the year after.
Yes.
Come on. Are you going to let him wander around Rochdale or Oldham?
Well,
have him deported, wouldn't you?
Whatever, I'm a giblet, if it was up to me.
Yeah, but
yes.
Some of his, for me, it's very, does that make me far right? I don't know. I've gone on my own political journey as well.
I don't care.
You know, and I look at it and think, okay, I'm at the viewpoint now where anyone who's a foreign national who's committed a crime in this country, that's, for instance, imprisonable. You set a certain tier, or a repetition, and you get rid of it.
Well, I mean, I'd go further and just say if you're not a taxpayer as well, because there's a lot of people on benefits as well. I don't quite understand why we import people and immediately put them on benefits. That doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me.
A lot of this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I come from a generation of immigrants who came here to work, or in the case of my father, landed here because he'd served in the Second World War. And the boat dropped him off in Liverpool and told him to make his
own. He was a Navy man, was he?
Yeah, yeah.
Royal Navy man.
Yeah, yeah. And they told him to drop his, make his own way.
Well, this is the thing I've always found, is the first generation immigrants are actually quite based when you speak to them. In fact, I often, if you want to hear blistering racism, speak to a first generation immigrant. I mean, they do not mess around at all with the way they describe any of this stuff. No. But okay, so. A balance of strengthening civic institutions, you know, slick deportations, white people need to stop pussying around and actually speak out about this because, you know, you can't just leave it to, you know...
And government campaigns to deal with the outright prejudice in the Muslim, Pakistani, Bangladeshi Muslim communities.
Yes.
As in a similar pattern to how these campaigns ran when we looked at the white working class communities historically.
Do you think there's something that's broken at this point? Because I was utterly despondent on this issue a year ago. But it does feel that through a combination of Elon Musk speaking out, this becoming an international story, the traction that reform is getting, and probably more than anything, Labour's a massive cack-handedness in dealing with
this
issue.
The end of them. This will be the end of many of their ministers. If it plays out the way it should play out, and we're campaigning for it to play out, this will be the end of the cozy arrangement.
So I do think it
I've got hope for this, you know, because the corrupt system, we more people now see it for what it is than ever before, and we know how to fix this. And fundamental to this, and I'll speak to Reform, I'll speak to the Conservatives, I'll speak to anyone who get rid of postal voting. Get rid of that system that allows for postal vote harvesting to operate in the way through which criminal cartels from within my community and Islamists use that. Yeah, come on. We went on a process where we believed in secret ballot. It was one of the Chartist, mandates. You go to a ballot box. No one can see where you put the cross. It shouldn't be postal vote by choice.
No, I'm even prepared to consider going slightly further than getting rid of postal voting and get rid of the. Just omit the word postal and just get rid of voting. I mean, I'm not sure His Majesty would do a better job, but I don't know if he could do a worse job necessarily.
Well, if you look at what Keir Starmer's done so far, and I think you look, it's only going to get worse, mate. It's not going to get better.
I mean, I can certainly...
Because he thinks he's right.
Well, yes, he does. I mean, he's just bloody weird, isn't he? But I can see the Labour Party not existing in 10 years' time. And by that, I mean, yes, they exist, but they're like UKIP. You know, it's just...
Or it'd be the metropolitan elite sort of places.
They still pick up one or two seats in Islington or something. Yeah.
You know how the Lib Dems are now?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing quite well at the moment, 60 seats. Or
yeah, but I think that's what they'll end up. I generally think if Reform get their act together...
I mean, it feels like they could actually win.
Reform?
Yes.
I campaigned in Oldham for 6 years, my town.
Yes.
I got 2,500 votes when I ran. I laughed at myself. Kept my deposit, 2,500 votes. Reform came along. No one knew who they were. No one knew who the candidate was. Yeah. 7,000 or 8,000 votes.
Well, they got branding.
Straight away.
Yes.
But it works.
Yes.
They just need to grow as a party. Because the Conservatives in these places are historically, you know, it's this cliche, isn't it? You know, my grandfather or my dad would have to turn in his grave if I voted. You know, does that... stigma attached to it. There is,
and the ones doing it are all bored boomers as well.
Yeah,
which doesn't help. With the issue with reform got is that it's kind of a one man band.
I started off looking at it and being challenging towards it, and then I step back and think no, it just needs time. If you believe in it, it needs time to start. You know, to normalize itself, get its systems and policies, procedures. It needs time to grow. I think. I think then And what I always say to myself is if people step forward and want to be the change that they want to see in the world and it'll benefit all of us, we need to support these people, whatever their political persuasions, and give them time to, you know, to grow and support. And if they grow, they've got time. They've got 3 years at least before a general election. Let's see what they.
I mean, personally, I'm a touch more radical. Like I say, I mean, I would just deport anyone who's foreign national or dual national who's committed crime and also on benefits and stuff like that. And after what you've told me, maybe this Jaipur region,
the Mirpur,
maybe you need to make people reapply for citizenship or something, and if they don't meet certain criteria,
they've got to be of value to the place, aren't they?
Well, yes.
You know, yeah, fundamentally, you know, you've got to be of value to the place. Yeah.
Well, me and the wife often talk about retiring somewhere nice and sunny, you know, Thailand or Spain or something like that. And I don't think for a moment the Thais would accept us if they didn't see a value for them. Yeah.
You financially contributing to it, yes.
Yes. Yeah. And what about, you know...
Your viewpoint isn't extreme, then.
I'm doing a segment with Stelios tomorrow where I'm going to make the argument that every political party around today is a left-wing party, because compared to basically any other period of time, even right-wing individuals today would be considered left-wing of, you know, 50-odd years ago. But they're too scared. Yes.
They're too scared and they're too busy trying to convince a demographic in terms of that metropolitan liberal elite. You'll never agree with them anyway. Why are you bothering arguing with people you know are never going to be on your side?
Oh, well, that's what we do now. We just step over all of that stuff and we just say remigration is inevitable. But, you know, the same way the left would always say that trans rights or what it's all inevitable, they would say. We're just kind of adopting the same tact and log. And what about sort of changing the pH level in the water somewhat and just making the place a little less attractive to Islam in general? Things like, you know, if we got food standards on slaughter, but we make exemptions for
halal kosher meat.
Get rid of that and just say, okay, well, no, sorry, if you really want your halal, you're gonna have to go vegetarian or go on holiday or not live here.
You've got a point, but you've got a point where you know, it's a reaction, isn't it? What you're saying is we want to make it unpalatable for these people to come because we know what they'll do when they get here.
Well, essentially, yes.
Yeah? And what my position is, for the love of God, before we get there,
yes,
the people who are here, do more so you belong, so you don't have to go that far.
Yes, because you've got to push to more radical stuff. So, any other successes you wanted to? You told us about that town that you took over. Are you getting more or less optimistic as we go on?
I'm getting more optimistic because the entire country now sees the situation for what it is.
Okay.
There was a time when we were far right, racist, whatever. And now it's very clear. We've just had a Labour Party government, vote through in Parliament to block a public inquiry.
Yes, it's a very bad look for them.
It's not a good look, is it?
Yes.
And the entire country agrees with us. I think sooner or later, over the next couple of months, we will force that public inquiry. That public inquiry will demonstrate not just the scale of the cover-up in terms of 100,000 and more, it'll demonstrate the complicity of a whole host of politicians.
Yes.
And then I think it's up to the Conservatives and Reform to do what they should be doing as political parties done. We've kicked the door in. We've gone in, and now, for the love of God, come in and help build a better country.
The downside of a political inquiry is Labour will get to a point ahead of it. And also it will kick the issue into the long grass for 3 or 4 years.
I will stop them. I'm 100% confident we'll stop them. We'll mobilise and we'll stop them. Yes. Already you're seeing...
But my point is once you've said, okay, we're going to have a public inquiry, that's going to take 3 or 4 years minimum, maybe 5.
No, we'll manage. It can be done in 2.5.
Right.
It can be done if you work backwards.
But my point is it kicks in. So for the next... So let's say you can do it in 2.5 years.
What?
For 2.5 years, Labour can just say, oh, well, we've got an inquiry, let's wait for that.
And this is a long game.
Yes.
You know, we've already spent 6 years doing this. This is a lot. For me, the tipping point is the next general election. And if we can get the information out in the way it needs to come out, and then the opposition parties use it to come up with whatever they come up with, then surely that is that, you know, because they've got a massive majority. Let's be clear. You know, they came in with a massive majority. And for that massive majority to be turned around and for them to be kicked out in one term, something remarkable politically has got to take place.
So if people are listening to this and they are, I mean, well, who are you, you're going to be looking for fellow travelers, people who can get involved and do things. What kind of people are you looking for? Is this for a start? Is it a northern phenomena?
This is happening across the country.
Right.
This is happening across the country, and all we're asking for is, because we are political, in terms of grassroots political, we're asking for people to contact their local councillors. Mm-hmm. Very simple. Contact your local councillor, whether it's a Conservative, Independent, Reform, if you have it. Ask them to convene what is known as an extraordinary council meeting. And you need 4 or 5 people, councillors, to sign a piece of paper, and an extraordinary council meeting is called. At that council meeting, there is a motion put forward condemning the government's refusal for a public inquiry, mm-hmm. writing off whatever its proposals are as inadequate, and to demand that the government launch a public inquiry. That letter goes to the Home Office, Reform, the Conservatives. If we can get 10 local authorities, 20, 30, 40, 50,
yes.
it gives us the what we need. And anyone can do that.
I see. So
that's the strategy. That's why I'm going around everywhere saying, please just do that. It is as easy as that. People think it's complicated.
So that's
to leave a democracy. It's not complicated. Yes. It's simple.
But that's something you can do anywhere, because I mean, my area of Winchester. I don't.
Even more important to care about children when it doesn't affect you.
Yes,
I think.
But there's no reason why my local council couldn't put out a similar motion.
100%, and they should, and they should. And do you know where we got it from?
Where?
I got it from the Islamists who were using it for the Gaza and the condemning of Israel and all of that. And I saw it all last year.
Right.
And now they're passing motions and they're mobilising. And I looked at it and thought, well, if they can do it, surely we can do it for our children.
Right. So talk me through this. So what if I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, oh, that seems like a sensible idea. I want my local council to condemn...
To pass a motion.
So they call
an extraordinary council meeting.
Yes.
Every constitution allows for the calling of extraordinary council meetings.
Yes.
It's usually 4 or 5 councillors have got to say, we demand an extraordinary council meeting.
Yes.
On this issue, this is the motion. They present that motion at the council meeting.
Okay.
It's voted on. Who's going to vote against this?
Yes. Right. So I'm watching this and I think, yes, that sounds sensible. I'm going to do that. Where do I get the motion? Is there a website?
I'll share it with you. It's just a draft motion we've produced. People have already passed it.
Right.
So it's towns, you know, and they adapt it to a local level. But
oh, well, if you share it with me, I'll put it in the description to this episode then.
Absolutely.
Right.
And all that then happens is it builds momentum and pressure. If 50 councils, 100 councils are telling the Labour government they've got it wrong and we want a national inquiry. Hmm. That's pressure. That's political pressure. That will give the Conservatives and Reform, whoever wants to run with it from the opposition, what they need to go back to Parliament. And if they vote against it, this is the thing, Dan. If they vote against it, we will then use that to remove
Very
them
good.
Anyway at the general election.
Yes.
This is political strategy. We'll beat them this way and we'll beat them the other way.
Yeah, well, you can imagine the pamphlets going out the next election. Yeah. So-and-so voted against an inquiry into the grooming gas.
Yeah.
Yes, that is quite potent. Yeah. And so the whole strategy is centred around capturing power or influencing power, but their path of the least resistance is in favour of what we want as opposed to ignoring it.
Yeah.
Force them to make a decision.
And we're winning. We're already winning because we're talking about how we're going to win, not whether we can win.
Yes,
the conversation shifted. Do you see? We're talking about how we're going to win, not whether we can.
I must say, it is quite a clever strategy because you only need to get 4 councillors or whatever it is on board, and then you force them all to go on record, and then you hang that over them at the next... That is actually quite clever. Yeah. I like that.
And you've got GB News, who will go and attend every one of these council meetings and report on them. Because you've now got a national media outlet who will, you know, Charlie and his guys have done well.
Yes.
And they should be applauded. You know, on this issue, they should be applauded.
Well, I will attempt to do this in Winchester, and if GB News somebody, I will deputise myself to go along my camcorder and...
Please. Yes. It's as simple as that. And
I like
the system is set up where they think we're powerless. We're not.
Yes.
It's as simple as that. It's as easy as that.
Brilliant. That's very clever.
Well, that has been most illuminating. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us while you're here?
We've got to find a way of living together. Otherwise, where is it going to lead us to?
Yes.
And I dread that, which is why I came down and I wanted to meet you and I wanted to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's 2026, not 2006. Your antivirus shouldn't feel like a dial-up. WebRoot Essentials protects your new and old devices without slowing them down. It scans 6 times faster, uses 33 times less space, and it's ranked #1 against Norton, McAfee, basically all the usual suspects. And right now, you can get an exclusive 60% off when you go to webroot.com/audio. Lock in the smarter, lighter, faster protection your devices deserve and get WebRoot Essentials today. That's webroot.com/audio for 60% off.